From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Senators are back in Washington today. House members don't think it's safe quite yet. Congress has already approved trillions of dollars in economic relief, but the big decisions about reopening the economy are being left to governors and, in some cases, mayors.
So let's bring in the mayor of New Orleans, where as many as one in four workers have lost their jobs. And in Orleans Parish alone, more than 400 have lost their lives. Joining us now is New Orleans Mayor LaToya Cantrell. Mayor, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, and right now your stay-at-home order is set to expire less than 2 weeks from now on May 15th. What are you going to need to see from the data to actually ease restrictions at that point?
Well, one is absolutely seeing a decline in new cases, in which we're starting to see that. But we are developing our benchmark in regards to what that needs to look like for the city of New Orleans specifically, as well as increased testing capabilities. While we have been testing here about 6% on a range of 6% of all of our residents here, which is very high, we want to be at a place where we can maintain and even expand that level of capacity, because we will have to do effective contact tracing, and it doesn't happen without an increased percentage of tests being available and readily available so that we can really box the virus in. While we have been living in an environment where the virus has had us, you know, boxed in, meaning at home, and as we look to shifting towards reopening, it has to have a strategy to where we're able to identify through that contact tracing and immediately be able to isolate, quarantine, to box in that virus so we do not get back to community spread.
Well, and when it comes to, I'm sorry to interrupt, but when it comes to contact tracing, your state has announced plans to hire 700 contact tracers. But according to NPR's reporting, that would get you only about halfway to the number of tracers that the state of Louisiana would need to start reopening.
Right, but also understand this as relates to contact tracing. It's not just something that government has to do or has the responsibility to do. It's the businesses themselves that will also contribute to the responsibility of contact tracing. They will know who comes to their establishment. They will have to be able to identify and trace and help us box it in and to prevent community spread. So the thought that contact tracing is solely government led is a false narrative. I don't see how government will plan itself in every business throughout, I know, the city of New Orleans. It just, that's unrealistic. So it's going to have to, we're going to have to build a robust contact tracing strategy that incorporates not only government, but the businesses themselves that are wanting to open back up.
Okay. And how much pressure would you say that you're feeling at this point to reopen? Because New Orleans went into the pandemic with the country's highest unemployment rate. And since the pandemic began, economists estimate the state's unemployment rate is about 25%. Are you under a ton of pressure just to reopen now?
Oh, yeah, I've received some pressure points that hit a little over 2 weeks ago, but was able to counteract that very quickly. It's not being bullied, you know, about it. It's going to be driven by the data and not the date. And so with that, temperatures have somewhat cooled down, and also with the realization that contact tracing is not just something that's government-led, that there is a responsibility of the businesses that are pushing to reopen. So I've kind of shifted a little bit of their thinking in terms of turning the map around a bit and having them focus on what their contact tracing plans will be, and also how government would be able to hold them accountable to those plans. Because again, the idea and the need is to prevent community spread. And that's something that we're coming out of, not something that we want to go back into, because we will have to shut down again.
Mayor, just 30 seconds here, but how does this compare to Katrina in New Orleans?
Well, one, during Katrina, it was something that happened specifically, you know, just in New Orleans. So with this pandemic, it's worldwide, it's global, and it's the United States being really the focal point. It also expanded the focus on disparities and health disparities that are prevalent in our urban environments and our urban cores across the United States of America. During Katrina, the laser and the focus was just on New Orleans.
Right.
And we were the blame.
That is the mayor of New Orleans, LaToya Cantrell. Mayor, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
Well, to Belgium now, which is lifting some of its lockdown restrictions as infection rates decline. But this small country has been hit hard by COVID-19, nearly 8,000 deaths, and they've been using new technology to help with social distancing. Rombit, a company which focuses on the maritime industry, has created a wristband that's being worn by dock workers in the port of Antwerp. John Bakelmans is Rombit's CEO. John, what does this wristband do?
Hey, Robin, thanks a lot for having us. So the wristband will keep people safe. The issue is that there is this new economy, the 1.5 meter. I think you guys say the 6 feet economy, where people want to be kept away from each other so that they cannot spread the virus further. The bracelet keeps people from each other and still working safe.
Well, because what? It buzzes when workers get too close to each other?
Correct. Yeah, it vibrates. And the closer you get, the harder it starts to vibrate. And when you go back to the safe position, it stops vibrating.
Now, look, we know you've already created wristbands for port workers, and they wear them in case of a hazard or to keep them out of certain zones. In that last one, John, it sounds like, you know, a dog collar, you know, that when they get too close to the invisible fence, they can't pass it. Is it that same technology for the workers to keep them out of maybe a more dangerous work zone?
Yeah, and that's exactly how we came to this idea. Huh? We were creating geofencing type of solutions to keep people in or out of certain zones. And that's why we had already the base technology. In a record time of a couple of weeks, we adjusted our software to make sure that they can work safely again.
Well, you know, we of course are thinking that this technology has been used for people under house arrest. They have ankle bracelets. They can't take off, or, you know, in South Korea, which has been terrific at, you know, tracking citizens with COVID-19, there's a bracelet they wear to see if anybody's left their quarantine, if they've been asked to go into quarantine. So, you know, some serious uses for this technology. But, you know, when I mentioned that it sounds like a dog collar, have you had people object to this notion that they're treated, you know, kind of like animals that are confined behind an electric fence? And, you know, people are capable of keeping 6 feet away from other people?
Yeah, so I want to put one thing straight. Huh? There is no way that people are being tracked from a location perspective per se. So we have communication between the different bracelets, and those bracelets themselves do not communicate position. There is no radio technology whatsoever to communicate outside of the bracelet. Because I agree with you, things like privacy, as you know, Europe takes those things very seriously. And of course, we would never have had even a possibility to go with this kind of solution to the market if there were privacy concerns. So we don't take those things very lightly.
Well, but you know, yeah, and I hear you, and we want to make that clear. There's no gathering of information here. But what about that notion that, you know, people are being zapped? I mean, it does have a whiff of, you know, treating people like animals. And, you know, I'm wondering if people are thinking, we don't need this. We can make these decisions ourselves.
Yeah, of course, that's the last thing we want to do is treating people like animals. We talked to a lot of workers and they say, listen, when we're getting into the swing of things, we might forget that safe distance kind of new way of working. And that's why they say it it actually is going to help them, especially in the first couple of days, couple of few weeks, stay safe while working. And we believe that over a period of time, they will keep a safe distance naturally.
Well, we understand you've received requests from 500 companies in nearly 100 countries. So do you see it being used? Let's say you pick one up when you go into the supermarket and just slip it on so you don't have to think about social distancing when you're shopping.
We actually created this device for workers in a more business environment. Of course, we get these requests. Can we handle those? Yes, we could. We want to give priority to those companies who can also use the bracelet for safe working under a crane, for example, in a port environment. If people want to create these geofences around a bracelet so that people can work in safe environments, and that's why we are working first with companies who can use it in that perspective versus only for social distancing.
What a great, great idea there. John Bakelsman is the CEO of Rombit, the Belgian tech company that's developed this wristband to help workers see when they've come too close to another worker. We'll have a picture for you at herenow.org. John, thank you.
You're very welcome. Thanks for the opportunity, Robin, and have a great day.
I love to scroll through my Twitter feed. I feel privileged to be made privy to such an outpouring of humanity. And recently, a tweet with a photograph of a beautiful but tired-looking young woman, her face covered in welts, stopped me in my tracks. "Both my patients died today," she wrote, "back-to-back codes. My face hurts, but my heart hurts worse." Her face was bruised by her N95 mask. Her name is Dominique Pierrot, and she joins us from Chicago. And Dominique, I'm so sorry. Could you mind telling us as much as you can what happened that day?
Well, so I actually ended up at this hospital through a sort of relief corps that the state of Illinois has created called Illinois Helps. I knew that it comes with risk. But for me, you know, I'm single. I don't have any children. So I figure there are people that are really do want to help, but they're afraid of, you know, bringing the infection home to their families, which I completely understand. So I don't really have that concern. It's just me and the dog. So I figure if I could sort of be someone that could take the place of someone who was, you know, afraid because of those reasons. I just wanted to be as helpful as I can during this. I know there's been a huge outpouring of people who are, you know, working in neighborhoods and helping with groceries and, you know, trying to support our other essential workers who are not just hospital workers. So I signed up for Illinois Helps to see, you know, if they could maybe direct me to hospitals that were in greater need. And these patients are sort of the sickest ones, and things happen very quickly. So, you know, that morning was the first one and was not expecting it at all. The team that I'm working with is great. But unfortunately, we could not save that person. And probably a half an hour later, the other one. So it was just a very overwhelming day. There's just not time to process things because, you know, after a person dies, we have to do, you know, our postmortem care. And for these particular patients, that care is a little more intense just for infection control purposes. So It was a long day.
Yeah. Oh, so many things here. It sounds like you're thinking of something slipped through my hands right now. But are you also thinking this is someone else's family? I mean, they're not there.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the worst part about all of this, actually, is that these patients are alone and it's just me. So, when this type of thing happens, you kind of have to walk that line between being their caregiver and being a family member. Sorry.
That's all right.
It's just hard.
Yeah. You know, we hear about nurses go out on social media and say, "Do you want us to, you know, send me a picture? I'll bring it." Do you feel you have to do something?
We are you know, showing them cards that their families have sent or pictures or trying to FaceTime with family, which has been really helpful for everybody. So it's a little bright spot in all the craziness.
Yeah. Oof. But I'm thinking of that moment. I mean, you're not a priest, you know, but yeah, I'm sure you like have a, I don't know, just something to acknowledge that moment.
You just try to kind of hold their hand and wait for, you know, the monitors to turn off and sort of be gentle and as caring as you can.
Oh, you know, to hear you say what you just said, I'm sure that meant so much to so many people to know, for them to know, you hold their hand.
I mean, it's what I would hope someone would do for my family if I couldn't be there.
Yeah. Okay. Look, we're hearing the toll it's taking. And you'd be, I'm sure you'd be the first to say, you know, to deflect it to, you know, the patients, the families. But I have to ask, we're sure you've heard of Dr. Lorna Breen. This is the top emergency room doctor in New York who both, you know, worked in the emergency room and then was a victim of COVID-19. You know, she took her life. Her father said there was absolutely no sign and that hers needs to be a story about the toll COVID-19 takes, both the disease and then the people, you know, working around it, the PTSD that health workers are going to have, maybe already have. We will never know what happened with Dr. Breen, but I'm wondering how that story resonated with you and your colleagues.
My condolences to her family. That's so awful. Mm. I remember seeing it come across the screen in the break room, and we all kind of just nodded, like, you know, like we all kind of understand, you know, the weight of it. I mean, we all have experienced death in our careers. That's not something that we're strangers to, but this is a lot more intense and a lot more, I guess, furious. Like, it just feels like I'm from the Midwest, so very familiar with storms and tornadoes, and to me the best way to describe it is that like roar that you hear in a tornado.
The impact of this illness.
Mm-hmm.
Nurse Perot, the country's split right now. Places have opened. There are people who haven't seen it at all. What would you want them to know?
Well, it's been really frustrating for me to see there've been a lot of people, some of my family included, that live in, you know, more rural parts of the country that are, it's not as bad as people are saying. It's a hoax. It's this, it's that. At first, you know, I would try to engage and maybe try to educate them a little bit. I don't know. I mean, we've just gotten to a point where people are either on one side of the line or the other, but we just don't know enough. You know, 3 weeks ago when I started this job, everybody was on hydroxychloroquine. And then the literature came out to say that, you know, that is not helpful and may in fact be harmful. So now no one's on hydroxychloroquine. We have to have a way to treat these patients consistently that works. And we just don't have that. I mean, we definitely are doing everything that we know how to do, which is called supportive care, which basically just means that we support your body with IV fluids and IV antibiotics and maybe a ventilator so that your body can maybe get better on its own. But we don't have, there's no miracle cure for this.
What do nurses need? What's the best thing that we can do for you all?
Oh, gosh. I've heard thank you more in the last probably 3 months than I have for in the 9 years that I've been a nurse. But there are so many other people that are involved in this, environmental services and respiratory therapy and pharmacy and physical therapy, occupational therapy, you know, people that help us do our jobs. So they definitely deserve just as much recognition. The thing that we would appreciate most is for people to just listen. Like, don't argue. Don't try to prove me wrong. Like, the thing that has been the most disheartening is how many people are just accusing me and my colleagues of lying. And I don't understand.
Wait, that happened to you? That happened to you after you posted this?
Oh, yeah. And there are several comments where people are, you know, I'm a liar and this is a hoax and you made this up for, you know, internet clout. It's just frustrating when people try to just smudge me by saying that because they didn't experience what I did or they weren't in the room with me or they couldn't video record me that I must have made it up. And I just wish that people would, when a physician or a nurse or a respiratory therapist or whoever who is in the hospital every day taking care of patients and taking care of COVID patients says, you know, please stay at home, please wear your masks, please, you know, limit the amount of times you go out, please don't sit in circles with your neighbors. You know, I know that it's hard. It's been hard for me. It's hard for everyone. But really, those are the only tools that we have left to try to slow the spread of this and to, you know, slow it enough that we can figure out how to manage it. I just wish that people would listen. That's what people could do.
That's nurse Dominique Perrot in Chicago, tweeting recently about losing two patients back to back, and we wanted to listen to what her experience is like. Dominique, thank you so much. I wish you all the best.
Thanks so much for having me.
And if you have a nurse you'd like to thank, maybe this one, leave a comment at hereandnow.org.
This is Here and Now from NPR and WBUR. I'm Jeremy Hobson. Today, fashion retailer J. Crew filed for bankruptcy protection after reaching a deal to restructure debt with its lenders. It is the first major retailer to take this action amid widespread business shutdowns across the country. For more, let's go to Jill Schlesinger, business analyst with CBS News and host of Jill on Money. Hi, Jill.
Hello.
So J. Crew barely escaped from filing for bankruptcy back in 2017. Why are they in such trouble?
Well, I think the most important part of your intro was the debt. So J. Crew carries $1.65 billion of debt. And that actually resulted from a previous transaction. Essentially, the company used to be a publicly traded company. It was then taken private. And in order to take it private, the equity group that did that borrowed money. And all of this debt has been weighing on this company year after year. 2017, they almost filed to get relief from that debt, but did not. And as a result, now what they're doing is they're taking the debt and they're turning it into ownership or equity.
So what will happen to the J. Crew stores when businesses are allowed to reopen?
Well, I think what's really interesting is that we don't know, first of all, that in Chapter 11, what they're hoping to do is renegotiate a lot of these deals, come out of bankruptcy, but we don't know how many stores will survive. So there are 182 different locations for J. Crew. There's another 140 Madewells, which is another part of this family, and 170 outlets of the J. Crew brand. I don't know how many of these stores are going to make it back. And I think that they're going to have a smaller footprint. We don't know which ones will survive and which ones will be shuttered.
Who else do you have your eye on when it comes to retailers that could follow a similar path? I know there's been talk about JCPenney or Neiman Marcus.
Yes, both of those very much widely in the news. We know that Macy's and The Gap have renegotiated a lot of their deals. All these retailers really have come into the pandemic period hobbled by trends that really have been going on for 20, 30, even 40 years. We know department stores have been struggling. One marketing expert said to me that coming into the pandemic, department stores were in the seventh inning of their lives. They're now in the bottom of the ninth. But many of these stores can come out of this period, again, smaller footprints, but they may have these brands that they license to others. So I'm also keeping my eye on Nordstrom as well. And some of the names that I think are going to slide through, these middle-tier retailers that just are losing out to the online brands, but also losing out to the idea that many people are going to be very comfortable shopping online when previously they weren't.
Well, you mentioned Macy's. Macy's announced plans to reopen stores in some places starting today.
Yeah, I think this is certainly ambitious. I think that there's a real issue around if they open, does it matter? Because maybe we weren't going to walk in there anyway. Maybe the pandemic wasn't this big moment in time where it makes a business rethink its business, but it accelerates all the plans that were already in place. And I think that that's likely to be the trend that we see specifically in these retail brands. I'm also interested in these fast casual brands. Let's see if people are going to be so quick to go to a Forever 21 and see if those brands survive.
Jill Schlesinger, business analyst with CBS News. Thank you.
Great to be with you, Jeremy.
We occasionally take a look at some of the ethical questions raised by the pandemic, how the tests are run, the restrictions. Early on, we watched protesters in Washington State angry they couldn't get into a nursing home to see a loved one there. Remember that? Seems like so long ago. And now people across the country are outside nursing homes looking in. One of them, ethicist Art Kaplan. He's head of the Division of Medical Ethics at the New York University School of Medicine. His mother, Natalie, died in the St. Patrick's Manor Nursing Home in Massachusetts a week ago today from COVID-19 at the age of 96. Art, I know you were metaphorically outside looking in. It was your sister who, you know, was trying to give her care from here in Massachusetts. Described her as a pistol, your mom. She sure sounded like one. We're so sorry.
Thank you. Yeah, she was a pistol. I know some people may be thinking, well, 96, good life, perhaps not as sad. It was sad. She was still enjoying her life, enjoyed going out to restaurants, loved getting her hair done, loved dressing up, loved music, all the arts and crafts she did. She was mentally with it. And she loved the visits from my sister. They really meant a lot to her. She was in there frequently.
Well, and then she had to stop, as visits to all nursing homes. Yeah, stopped. And your sister said that your mom just really declined precipitously at that point. And, you know, there are people, we remember those protesters. There are people still saying, can't we make exceptions here? If they're going to be sick anyway, if they're old anyway, talk about the ethics. I mean, I want to talk more about your mom, and thank you for being able to talk just a week later. But did you ever question the ethics of being denied entry to the nursing home?
Oh, yes. Yes. So when she caught this thing maybe 3 weeks ago, she went into isolation. My sister tried to visit her by going to a window outside her room and tapping on it, holding up signs, urging her to drink and eat. But she stopped eating. I have a feeling she lost her appetite as part of the symptom. You know, that seems to be one of the consequences of the virus. But again, now she's in her room. She has no access to anybody. Meals are kind of brought in and the staff run away because they're afraid of COVID and they're not necessarily with the right equipment, and you have no exercise, you have no nothing. She was clutching the phone, hoping that one of us would call her. So you got to really understand how sad this situation is, what isolation really means. And yes, I thought, can't we get gowned? Can't we get masked? Can't we go in there to at least, you know, have a goodbye? But the protective gear wasn't around. Mm.
So that doesn't become an ethical question. It becomes a practical question.
It does. And you have issues of, well, who could go in? Could a religious chaplain type person go in? Would it be better for my sister to go in? What are the risk factors of going in? A lot of people with a mother or dad, grandpa, would say, I don't care what the risk factors are. I'm going in. I got to hold their hand. I want to have my last words. You know, it's even difficult in these situations. We think of FaceTiming and iPads, but they don't have them in these nursing homes, and they don't know how to work them, certainly the residents. So some of the means that we use, Zoom and so on, just aren't there.
Well, but as an ethicist, you say, you know, yeah, there are questions about why can't I go in and see my grandparent, my loved one? But the answer is because there are other people in there as well. And, you know, talk about that part of this, the e pluribus unum part of this, that everyone's actions aren't just their own actions.
Yeah, the nursing home is a tiny little community. People are coming in all the time when you're not in a COVID positive room to do something or someone to change an ostomy bag. But these are temporary people. You know, nursing homes are kind of the forgotten part of the healthcare world. So what I'm saying is they're moving the virus around inside the nursing home. If you get an outbreak, it's a recipe for disaster. I think 80 people died in a home in Holyoke, Massachusetts during the same time last week. There were 90 reported dead in a New York City nursing home. The conditions in nursing homes aren't great. And when you worsen them by having to keep COVID-positive people with part-time staff, it just becomes like an incubator for disease.
Yeah. By the way, did you become resigned? You, the ethicist, wrestling with this question with your own mother in a nursing home, did you become resigned to, well, no, it wouldn't be ethically right to go in now?
I did. Yeah. I accepted it. Yeah. I knew it was going to be too hard for them to manage that at the home. She's too frail, move out, so that wasn't a possibility either.
Yeah. Well, you've also taken a stand on an ethical issue in human vaccine trials. Some volunteers are being injected with a test vaccine, but researchers aren't exposing them to the virus. That is rarely done in a human trial. That's what happens in animal trials. Mm-hmm. They're kind of just going to follow them and see if they come in contact with a virus. Somehow will the vaccine fight it off. You say that needs to change right now. Really expose humans to this deadly virus?
Yeah. If we're going to get out of this horrible pandemic, which is taking hundreds of thousands of lives in North America and I don't know how many around the world, we're going to have to speed up vaccine development. You hear some of our politicians saying, I heard Trump say today, 6 months. There is never going to be a vaccine in 6 months because it would take a couple of years to show that it worked if you just rely on immunizing people and then seeing whether naturally they get sick or they don't. My proposal is we get volunteers who consent to get vaccinated in young age groups so that the death rate is very, very low from the disease and deliberately then challenge them with the virus. That would speed up the process by years.
Well, I mean, again, the ethicist is asking what? Your question would be what's best for the planet, not necessarily the individuals? I mean, how do you gauge that?
Yeah. So partly it's how do we cut deaths by millions potentially over many years if we let the volunteers do what I'm suggesting. And then even the volunteers, we could take them from young age groups that are high risk exposure, people who might be first responders or healthcare workers or nursing home workers are getting exposed anyway at pretty high levels. So if you knew what was going on, you knew when they were infected, you could follow them closely, then I think you'd get your answer. And people have said to me, well, who's going to do that? Well, actually, I think there are about 10,000 people so far online who volunteered.
Yes. In fact, there's a bill in Congress asking regulators to approve these so-called challenge trials for the coronavirus vaccine. There's a website, onedaysooner.org. More than 10,000 people globally have volunteered to take part. But, you know, people volunteer to sell their kidneys and things, and we don't let them do that.
Although, by the way, Robin, we do let them donate their kidney, and the risk factor there of dying is about the same as what we're talking about for a young person with COVID.
But I guess I'm saying there are some things we don't allow because of concern for the individual. You're saying that the concern here is on the side of our future, and for that reasoning, people should be allowed to do it.
That's right. I think people should be allowed to do it to protect so many more of the rest of us. It's a really altruistic act. Obviously, they have to be fully informed. They have to do it. I wouldn't pay them because I don't want anybody suggesting they're doing it for money. I want them to do it for pure altruism. And I think they could really contribute to getting us not just out of the deaths from this thing, but getting people back out and the economy going and all the rest of it. It's not just who's going to die because they get infected. It's who's going to die because they can't put food on the table.
Yeah. Art Kaplan, we started by noting your mom's passing from COVID-19 just within the week. What do you say to people? And we're seeing the protests who say, I'm not going to wear masks. I mean, Vice President Mike Pence has apologized for not wearing a mask. But, you know, people who say, I'm just not going to do it. Either I'm against government tyranny or it's become a political symbol. People who are rejecting the social distancing. What are the ethics there?
Well, I'd say your right to go get a tattoo seems weak relative to killing grandparents. There's really no other way to protect the most vulnerable than by engaging in the social distancing and the hand washing and the masks. And I hear what people say about they don't want to be told what to do, but I think that comes at too high a price if you're going to wind up having the kind of Holocaust we're seeing in the nursing homes.
Hmm. Well, people didn't like seatbelts either for a while.
That's true.
Art Kaplan, head of the Division of Medical Ethics at New York University School of Medicine, and most important for this conversation, the son, one of the children of Natalie Kaplan. Again, Art, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me, and thanks for letting me talk about my mom.
We've talked a lot about the healthcare side of this pandemic, but for many Americans, the most pressing issue is economic. More than 30 million people have now applied for unemployment benefits, which does not count the many who have tried and failed to apply for those benefits. And many are unable to make their rent payments for the month of May. It's already May the 4th. Derek Thompson has been looking at how this pandemic continues to hit people economically. He's senior editor at The Atlantic, and he joins us from Washington. Hi, Derek.
Hi, Jeremy.
So at the beginning of this crisis, politicians said, don't worry so much about the economic stuff because it's only temporary and everything will come back, roaring back just like it was. But people have been unable to work for almost 2 months now in some places. Many Americans don't have the savings to get them through that.
Yeah, I would say do worry. From the beginning, we had a pretty clear idea that this was going to be a disaster. And I think it's fair to say that from a labor market perspective, it's been about as bad as we feared. You're talking about an unemployment rate that's probably around 20%. That's twice as high as the worst month of the Great Recession. It's almost as high or maybe exceeding the worst month of the Great Depression, meaning it might be the highest unemployment rate in American history. To the government's credit, there is a plan to make sure that people have money even if they're not working. And it's a three-part plan. First, you have the $1,200 checks that are being sent out to the vast majority of Americans, at least those in the middle class. You have beefed up unemployment insurance, which is helping a lot of Americans make closer to what they would have made if they were formerly employed in the economy full-time. And then you have PPP, the Payroll Protection Program, which is the government paying companies to not fire their workers. You put all of that together, it's a patchwork safety net, but a patchwork safety net is definitely better than no safety net at all. And this has been the government's response to what is truly an unprecedented labor market crisis.
Well, Derek, it's one thing for so many people to be getting unemployment benefits and having the uncertainty that goes along with not knowing when they're going to have a regular paycheck again. What are the economic consequences, though, of so many people dealing with a level of income that is different and lower probably than what they had before?
You know, it's interesting because at the beginning of the crisis, people talked about this being a supply side crisis. That means that the U.S. wouldn't be able to get all sorts of electronic equipment or agricultural products from other countries because those markets are being shut down. What we're seeing right now, as you just pointed out, are the beginnings of a demand side crisis. You have Americans who don't have enough money potentially, especially if they're not getting jobless benefits, to pay for essentials, whether it's food, toilet paper, you know, healthcare, if they need it. I think that what we're seeing and what's truly the most concerning thing about this is that if the federal government can't give give individuals money to live soon, we could see starvation, we could see people struggling to make ends meet, and we could also, at sort of the broader level, see a demand-side crisis intersecting with a supply-side crisis. And that's really the beginning of something that's not just an economic recession. It's more like an economic depression.
What about on the business side? Today, for example, in Florida, they're allowing many businesses to open up, but at partial capacity. In that state, 25% capacity. These businesses still have all their expenses. Many have not gotten loans or grants from the government, although some have. Can we really get back to a situation where everybody's able to get their jobs back, where everybody is able to be employed as they were before, if businesses can only be operating at partial capacity for the foreseeable future?
Yeah, this crisis has really cleaved the economy in two. There's a handful of companies that are doing sensationally well. If you're, you know, delivering almost anything, whether it's pizza or all sorts of products like Amazon and Instacart, but there's a lot of other businesses that are in the face-to-face economy that just can't operate right now. And my concern for them is twofold. First, I want them to be able to hold their breath in a no-oxygen environment. That's right now, where you have stores shut down. People cannot walk into them. That's a no-oxygen environment, and right now they just need to hold their breath and get through it. But as you alluded to, the reopening of America, when it comes, is going to be a low oxygen environment. It's going to be a period of time when restaurants can't be full capacity. Movie theaters can't be full capacity. Stadiums might have to be empty. And that's why we need, I think, a two-part plan. We need a plan like PP to prepare for today's no oxygen world, but we also need a plan for the world that's going to come after that, where companies are going to have to operate at 25, 50% capacity.
When we already got a sense of that over the weekend, Warren Buffett said that he had sold all of his shares, or Berkshire Hathaway, his company, had sold all of their shares in the four largest U.S. airlines. He says he doesn't know if 3 to 4 years from now people will fly as many passenger miles as they did last year. There are too many planes. Sounds like that statement may apply to more than just airlines, Derek.
Yeah, Buffett said, you've got too many planes. I think you could say we've got too many fill in the blank for a lot of things. We have 10 times more physical retail shopping space per capita than Germany. We have 3 times more than Canada. So we are massively over-retailed. And as a result, I think not only because of the crisis keeping people in their homes, but also because of the coinciding growth of e-commerce, you're going to see a lot of physical retailers not be able to hold their breath during this depression. You already saw it today. J. Crew filed for bankruptcy. We're going to see a lot more of those because there is just too much retail space, and America is going to have to constrict its retail space going forward.
That is Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic. Derek, thanks as always.
Thank you.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.